All right, good evening, everybody. Welcome back. Great to see so many of you. And we have just a quick reminder for those who have not yet gone on to the Shoresh website, or you can even just text me and tell me how much you want to pledge. You don't have to pay it now, we'll take care of it. But we have until midnight tonight. All donations are tripled. So if you haven't done it, go for it. Okay, that being said, let us take our first look at tonight's Mishnah. Tonight's Mishnah. Here we are. Number 10. Shemaya and Avtalion received from them. Again, we're talking about the tradition from Rebbe to student, from teacher to student. Shemaya would say, here we go, love work, loathe mastery over others, and avoid intimacy with the government. Oh, how relevant this Mishnah is. Oh my, oh my, oh my. Let me give you a little background here, right? Let's just to take in these three things: to love work, to hate. The actual word in the Mishnah is usinai. Sina means sina, is hatred. Loathe it. In Hebrew, it's rabbanut, which some of you might know just as a position of rabbinical authority, but it means the government. We'll see in a minute. And don't get too close. In Hebrew, titvada means to have a close connection with the government. We'll come back to all three of them, but who are these two people? Shmaya and Avtalion. Anyone ever hear their names before? Not your standard names. Shmaya and Avtalion are two amazing people. Amazing, I say, because they both descended from converts. And they became, as I mentioned many, many weeks ago, when you have the pairing in the Mishnah. One was the head of the court, the Av Beit Din, and the other was the Nasi, like the president, like the principal man. These two rose to such unbelievable prominence within Jewish leadership that it really is, it's inspirational. Who do they descend from? So you have to know a little history here. Let's go back. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but there was, if you read in the book of Malachim, in the book of Kings, the second one, it talks about the leadership. It goes from this king to that king. And then at some point, there's a split in the kingdom. After King Solomon, there's a split, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And there's kings in both areas for many, many hundreds of years. There's a story about a man by the name of Sanherev. Sanherev was a king from another country, and his attempt was to conquer, and in fact, he was successful at conquering the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom of Israel, where 10 of the 12 tribes were situated. The southern kingdom is where the temple stood, and there was a breakaway after King Solomon, and the northern kingdom, they basically didn't want any connection. This was our first real civil war within the Jewish people. And this man Sanherib came and he conquered the northern kingdom and ultimately exiled, had a hand in exiling the famous, what we call the lost 10 tribes, right? The 10 lost tribes. That's where they came from, the northern kingdom. Make a long story short, Sanherib then attempted to come down and conquer the southern kingdom. He besieged Jerusalem, but a miracle happened and Sanherib's army, all many of them, were wiped out by an angel overnight. And when the Jews woke up in the morning, they saw that the army had fled. Sanherib was running for his life, and they couldn't figure out exactly why. I recommend highly that you read it. It's fascinating. But these two people, these two great, Shmaya and Avtalion, are descendants from Sanherib. Somewhere along the line, one of Sanherib's descendants decided to convert to Judaism, and they are children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren of those descendants of those converts. They lived during the time of the Second Temple, as all of these that we're talking about and of the Mishnayos that we study, they're during the Second Temple era. Now, a little bit of history here as well. A major difference between Temple One and Temple Two. In Temple One, the level of spirituality was on a much, much higher level than it was during Temple II. I say that because number one, the Ark, which was in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, was not there in the Second Temple. What was there was the famous rock, what's known as the foundation rock, Evin HaShitsiyah. What, do you ever wonder why they call that mosque Dome of the Rock? Yeah, that's why. Is because the rock of foundation that the God began the creation of the world from is there. That's the spot where the ark was. During the Second Temple, the ark wasn't there anymore, and just the rock was used as that point, as that space, as that landmark. There were many other differences in this Temple One, but where it manifests most is that the position of Kohen Gadol, the high priest. You can imagine, we grow up, we read the stories. Who's the first high priest that comes to your mind?
Aaron. Aaron.
Aaron. Aaron HaKohen. I mean, this is Moshe's brother, and you think of a great, great person, which he was. And the truth of the matter is, the overwhelming majority of Kohanim Gedolim, high priests, during Temple One era were righteous, righteous individuals. Really, really excellent. Super spiritual leaders and role models. However, during Temple Two era, that became a position that became corrupted. So much so that they would auction off that position. And it was bought, clearly not by the best and the brightest, but those who had money, they bought the position. Now, they went through so many high priests. Year after year, they would get a new one. Why? Not just because they wanted to make money.
They died when they went into the
Exactly, Fred. Because on Yom Kippur, when the day that the only the Kohen Gadol goes into the Holy of Holies, if you are not up to par, if you're not up to snuff spiritually, dude, you ain't gonna make it out. And in fact, that's the way it was. The Mishnayos talk about that when the Kohen Gadol went in, he wore a rope around him so that if, God forbid, he were to not make it out alive, because most people, if you're exposed to that level of spirituality, your soul, your body, you can't handle it because God's presence is so exposed there. That's why only the highest level person, spiritual person, the Kohen Gadol. So he would wear a rope, and 9 out of 10 times, 99 out of 100 times during the Second Temple era, every year, the Kohen Gadol obviously was not on that level. He died, and they pulled him out, and they had to appoint a new person next year. And that's the way it went. So during that Second Temple era, when Shmaya and Naftalian are living, they're going through a period of political struggles, political corruption. Not just in the high priest position, but just leadership in general was going through an extremely tumultuous time. And what we find from the teachings of Shmaya and Naftalian, which we'll see God willing next week, they all are trying, they're both trying to impress upon us the importance of teaching the nation to stay above the fray and to focus on our loyalty to the true leadership of God and the Torah. Not to get too caught up in all of the political shenanigans that go on. You think to yourself, oh, this is only something new, only here in this country. Folks, this has been going on for thousands of years. Political nonsense. And I'm not meaning it in a derogatory way. You need leadership. We'll see a Mishnah, God willing, in Pirkei Avos later, that you have to have some level of government and authority, a hierarchy, because if there's anarchy, people do the craziest things and there's no control. So it's good to have some societal boundaries that are put in by a government kind of system. However, the system of government is fraught with danger. And the more you get into it, the more you realize it. Shmaya and Naftalian are trying to remind us that it has its place, but be very wary. These are words of caution about the danger of power, the corruptive potential that's within government, the need to strengthen ourselves as a nation from within, what we hold true, what our value systems are. So let's go through this a little bit now. That's the background to it. So let's look at this Mishnah again. Shmaya Naftayim would say, Shmaya would say, O ehov et hamalacha. Love work. Love work. You're all scratching your head. Why would I love work? I would much rather not have to work. I would much rather to have time to myself, not have the pressures, not have the stress, not have everything that comes along with work. But some of you are smart enough to know that that's really a fallacy. You know what work provides? Name something what you think work provides that the mission is encouraging us to love it.
Discipline.
Discipline. If you have time on your hands, you waste it. Here you know you have a structure. I need to be at work by such and such a time. I have to be productive during my time. I have things that I have deadlines. It's such a great work ethic to be able to be disciplined. What else?
Satisfaction.
Great satisfaction. You're accomplishing something. Isn't that at the end of the day, after 120 years, when we get called up to heaven, don't you want it to be that we can look back and say, I accomplished something? I was productive. I made a difference in this world. Being part of a productive work society leads to that. What else?
Passion,
What do you mean?
like being passionate about your work, as far as like more of a calling in a sense, doing what your mission is, basically.
Okay, good, excellent. What else? How about just simple? You guys are already way advanced and you guys are so smart about this stuff. Just a very simple thing. What is a major difference between somebody who's working and somebody who's not working? And I'm not talking finances.
That's where I was going, money. But
You're busy.
That's a key phrase, Jeff. You are kept busy. Let's be honest. When we have time on our hands, we get into trouble. It's a fact. Idleness leads to laziness, which leads to trouble. The kids sitting around in the summer, I'm not promoting any particular camp, but let's go ahead and not just have kids sitting around all summer because it only is asking for trouble. So even on the most basic level, the Mishnah tells us you should go to work. Go to work. It's so important that it not be just an absolute waste. Keep you out of trouble.
Obviously, you're not cognizant of all the people in your class here.
I am cognizant because you've all put in your time.
We're done.
Yes,
I'm not done.
but the
Robin's
truth
not
is,
done.
no, but the truth is, the lessons of it are still very important. Most of you, I venture to say all of you, the fact that you have some kind of structure to your day is a direct result of having worked your whole life. You don't want to be sitting around doing nothing. Yes, you enjoy the fact that you don't have the crazy hours and the amount of stress that you did when you were full-time working. I get that. But that ethic of being able to live productively, even in your retirement or semi-retirement or whatever phrase you want to call for the life that you're in right now, is because you put in that time. So, first and foremost, you should love the fact that you work. It keeps you out of trouble. Number two is that I think you're right. Someone said it before, is that you see productivity. It's accomplishing, it's satisfying. I think, Demirio, that was your phrase, right? You feel it's satisfaction. You're making such a difference. I got to tell you, let's go through this very carefully because there's so much I want to say about this. When God created the first man and woman, when he created the world, did they work?
No.
No.
How do you know? They were in the Garden of Eden, right?
Was nothing to do. Everything was
No.
provided.
Everything was provided, meaning
They didn't have to work.
They had too much time on their hands.
They had, well, see, it led to trouble. See, I told you. But you're not wrong. The Midrash, I mean, they all, the Torah itself says that God placed Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and the Talmud tells us, like exactly like Jeff said, that all their needs were taken care of. No effort was expended or exerted on their part. Now, what happens? They sin, and what's the curse that God gives Adam in particular? Anybody
It
remember?
was work or something.
You have to work.
Yeah, is that the phrase?
Something about by the brow of your.
Yeah, here you go. Come on, Fred.
It was basically you had a. All right, I forget the exact wording, but it's.
Toil with the sweat of their brow, of his
There you
brow.
go. Now we're
That's it.
getting there. To Adam, he said, because you listened to the voice of your wife. That was mistake number one. No, just kidding, just kidding. Got to read the whole sentence. Because you listened to the voice of your wife and ate of the tree about which I commanded you, saying you shall not eat of it, accursed is the ground because of you. Through suffering shall you eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles shall it sprout for you, and you shall eat the herb of the field. By the sweat of your brow shall you eat bread until you return to the ground from which you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust shall you return. The idea that we have to, machaleben, that we have to work for a living, is only as fallout, as a result of them sinning. But my question is, why do I still have to work? Shouldn't I just place my trust in God? Isn't it God who provides? So if I trust that God will provide for me, that should be enough. I'm sure I shared the famous story about the boy who comes to take out a girl, and the prospective father-in-law wants to have a conversation with him. So he asks him, he says, tell me a little bit about yourself. He says, I'm doing this, that, fine. He says, and how are you in school? He says, no. Are you working? No. Well, how are you going to support my family? How are you going to support my daughter? God will provide. He says, okay. And do you have any plans for futures? No, God will provide. And every question about how he's going to support anyone, his answer was the same: God will provide. And he says, okay, go right ahead, go out with my daughter, have a good time. The wife looks at the husband as soon as the young girl, the young boy and girl leave. She looks at him and she says, since Yiddish is the phrase of the night, du bist mishega? Are you nuts? What, are you crazy? The guy didn't give you a single good answer. He said, God will provide, God will provide. What kind of stupid nonsense is that? How's he going to support our daughter? He looks at his wife and he says, honey, we've had other guys come through here and they all have given us answers. But be honest, has anyone ever called us God? What's wrong with it? I'll even show you I'm right. Let's talk about a story. A story about Yosef, Joseph. He's languishing in prison, right? Because of this framed by Ashes Potiphar, the wife of Potiphar. Fine, he's there for 10 years. And then the story about the wine steward and the baker, they have their dreams. We all know this. And he interprets their dreams. And exactly what he says is what comes true. As he tells the wine steward that he will be reinstated back to his post, he asks the wine steward to please remember me and mention me before Pharaoh and get me out of this place. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring this to your attention because I want to ask you, isn't that appropriate? Isn't that the right approach that Yosef, if Yosef is thinking, listen, God, of course, has got to get me out of here, but this is the mechanism by which God must be doing it. So I have to do my part to go ahead and do it. Yes? He's actually punished for 2 more years. The Midrash tells us that because he asked the wine steward to get him out, he's punished and he has to stay 2 more years. And only then does Pharaoh have his dream. And that's when he's able to be taken out and interpret. And we go forward from there. Why? Isn't that what putting your faith in God means? So why is he punished? This is not my question, but it's a great question. So put your faith in God, he's punished. But on the other hand, I'm required to do work. Do you know what day a week are you not supposed to do work?
Shabbos.
You sure?
The seventh day.
Good answer, right? Of course it's Shabbos, right? But let me ask you, every single time in the Torah where it talks about Shabbos, it is always preceded with a sentence or a phrase. The end of the phrase is always, but on the seventh day is Shabbos to Hashem, you shall not do work, is always preceded with a phrase of 6 days shall you work. You ever notice that? It does not mention Shabbos of not working without the context of 6 days of working. Why? Because that's the right thing to do. You can't have Shabbos 7 days a week. You cannot sit on your duffy and just expect it to happen. You have to put forth an effort. So which one is it, Rabbi? Is it put your faith in God, don't trust anything else, or put in the effort, make up your mind? The answer is it's both. The answer is it's both. You have to go ahead and put in all the effort that you can, 110%. But when you are successful and putting forth all 110% and it produces what it is you want and accomplishes and gives you what you need, don't think it was all yours. Don't forget you had a silent partner who helped you be successful called God. The two have to work hand in hand. You have to do what's called hishtadlut. To be mishtadel means to put forth your effort, but at the same time, bitachon is to have trust and faith in God that He provided it. The two work together. So now I go back to the story of Yosef. And just by the way, it's not so simple. It's not easy to give God credit because we've worked so hard. We put in all the effort. We came up with a great chop. We came up with a great, that's a great thing we should do. And that nets us, that netted us a great win. I came up with a new thing or a new way or a more efficient way. Good for me. The business can make more money. Or I got a promotion. Or look what I did. Look what I did. Look what I did. It's hard to give recognition back to God. And we fall into the trap of, I did it all by myself. You know, the manna that fell from heaven, how often did it fall?
Six
6 days.
days.
Every day of the week except Shabbos, because God also doesn't work on Shabbos, right? So, if, and I, what did we have? What were we going to eat on Shabbos? We got a double portion on Friday. That's why we use two challahs for the Shabbos meals, okay? To represent, to symbolize the two portions that came for Shabbos on Friday. But how often did it come? It came every day. Why? It's such an inefficient system, God. Why don't you give us a week at a time? Or give us a month at a time? And you can come up with a way to refrigerate it. That's not my issue, God. You can figure it out. Make it such, you know what? It didn't spoil on when you got two portions on Friday, it didn't spoil on Shabbos. So extend the miracle a little further and it won't spoil like Friday to Friday, like in Sarah and Rachel in Sarah's tent, in Rebecca's tent. The challah stayed fresh all week. God couldn't do that. So why didn't he, it's so inefficient to have to come to God every single day. Give me a week at a shot or a month at a shot. The Talmud asks this, and the Talmud says, because it's a very profound lesson. I want you to come to me every single day, God says. Why? Because you and I are in a relationship. I don't want it to be that I just give you what you need and I don't hear from you for a week. That's not a relationship. That's a vending machine. God is not a vending machine. He doesn't want it. All you got to do is put in the right amount, punch in a couple of codes, and you get your entomans, whatever. Right? That's not how it works. God wants it that He have a relationship with you. You know where I can prove this to you? Name me the only creature that has no relationship with God whatsoever, and that's a punishment.
Snake.
Bingo. That's right, Marsha, the snake. We talked about Adam's punishment. We'll skip Chava, Eve's punishment for now. But what's the punishment for the snake in the
Yes, to
Garden of Eden
slither on his
story?
belly and
It's got
eat
to
dirt.
slither on its belly, but what does it say? You'll eat dirt, dust, all the days of your life. Yeah, and where is earth found?
On the ground.
Where? Any particular location?
On the surface of
All
It's
over.
everywhere. It's endless. Every other creature has to go hunt or be given for its food. There's no other creature that it's all provided wherever they go, whatever. The lion has to go hunt. The deer has to go. Everyone has got to go get something. The cow even has to bend down and graze. If you eat it up here, you got to slowly move over there. But there's got to be some effort on your part. No, not the snake. This is part of the curse that it's given. Why? Because God said, I want nothing to do with you anymore. That's the ultimate banishment. So when we have the mun, not we, but when they had the mun, it was Hashem's way of saying, I want to have this relationship with you so that you always remember that I'm your silent partner in your success. Working towards a goal is actual service to God. I'll prove it to you again. We make a bracha in the morning, right? One of the earliest brachos we make when we daven in the morning is a bracha on the Torah. Asher bachar banu mikol ha'amim, the same bracha we make when we get an aliyah, right? When we get called up to the Torah. We're supposed to say that every day. What happens, right? What you're supposed to do is you're supposed to say that bracha and you're supposed to learn a little. Now, if you follow along in your Siddur, most, I would say at least many, maybe most Siddurim have actually a couple of verses and a Mishnah and a Braita quoted right afterwards so that you qualified as you took time to learn right after you made the bracha on learning Torah. It's no different than if I make a bracha on an apple and I don't eat the apple right away. Well, that's what we call a bracha levatala. That's a bracha in vain. Can't do that. It's using Hashem's name in vain. When you make a bracha on something, you're supposed to do the action right away. So if I make the bracha on learning Torah and then I go off to work, well, that would seem to be analogous to making a bracha on the apple and eating the apple 3 hours later. That doesn't work. And yet the law is that when I come home from work and I find a little time to go on to a Zoom class at 8 o'clock on Wednesdays, just hypothetically speaking, you don't have to make the bracha again. Why? Because the bracha you made in the morning covers for now. Hey, wait a second. I had an 8, 10, maybe 12-hour day in between. If I got up late and I made the bracha at 8 in the morning, which for me is very late. And I don't start learning Torah till 8 o'clock at night. That's a 12-hour interruption. Why don't I have to make the bracha again? The answer is because if you spent the 12 hours in the middle actually in putting into practice all that you learned in the Torah, meaning you go to work and you're being honest in your job and you're applying all the ethical principles you learn in the Torah, that's called living Torah. You don't have to make a bracha. There's no interruption. You go straight from the bracha of learning Torah right into putting it into practice. No need to make the bracha again. But that action, the action of doing the work, is service to God. So now we go back to Yosef. Let's bring this full circle. Wasn't he simply doing what was necessary? He was doing his part to get out of jail. This is his activity. This is the work, the hishtadlut. He's doing his part to get out. So why is he punished? So I have to read you the phrase very carefully so you'll appreciate it. And again, we have to remember that this is about Yosef. This is not about Zvi Tachman. It's not about all of us because we're not on Yosef's level. But let me read you what he says. Very important phrase. He turns to the wine steward and he says the following. If only you would think of me with yourself when he benefits you. Again, the wine steward, if you'll remember me when Pharaoh benefits you, and you will do me a kindness if you please and mention me to Pharaoh, then you would get me out of this building. For indeed I was kidnapped, yada yada. What did he say that was wrong? Should I read it again? Let me read it again. If only you would think of me with yourself when he benefits you, and you will do me a kindness if you please, and mention me to Pharaoh, then you would get me out of this building. What don't you like about that phrase, that phraseology?
He's saying that that he would get him out of the building, that the power would be upon him saying something to Pharaoh, not God.
Okay, excellent. And that is the way it's phrased, sounds like that he's turning to the wine steward and saying, hey, do me a favor, go speak to Pharaoh so that you can get me out of here. It would have been better had Yosef said, please speak, mention me when he benefits you, and mention me to Pharaoh so God can get me out of this building. That would have been the right answer. Now, if we had said something like that, I suspect God would say, that's pretty close enough. Tuchman, I'm giving you credit for that. But for Yosef, that was not appropriate. And the truth is, if you look further, when he finally does get taken out and he interprets Pharaoh's dream and Pharaoh wants to give him credit for being the great interpreter of dreams, his response is, it's not me, God is the interpreter of dreams. He actually learned his lesson and applied it appropriately. So, our mission when it comes to work, first and foremost, is to recognize it keeps us out of trouble, number one. Number two, it's so beneficial to us. We learn the work ethic and discipline and all the satisfaction of it. But even more so, and this story about Yosef, it teaches us that the actual work can be viewed as a service to God. So Shmaya's first teaching to us is love work. It's good for you. Even if you're retired, work, do something. Doesn't have to be what you used to call work, but stay busy, make it productive. Every study in the book all talks about this. Keep yourself sharp. Keep yourself busy. Don't sit around doing nothing. Okay, number one. Number two, this is a harder one. This one says, loathe mastery over others. Hate. Rabbanut is what it says in Hebrew. You should hate authority. Now, you got to be careful there. Whoa. Is this suggesting that we have a coup? That's not what it is at all. But rather, it's to hate and to have a certain reticence about authority, positions of authority. I want to be very clear. He is not suggesting that there should not be positions or people in positions of authority. It is critically necessary. But don't let that power go to your head. We have seen this time and time again. It's not limited to governments. It's not limited. It's true all the way around. Positions of authority. What is it? Power corrupts. Absolutely. How's it go? Absolute power
corrupts. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Correct. And we have to be on guard for that. And it's not only at a position in government. It's true in a position in a job. It's true in a position in a shul. It's true in a position in a family. Power corrupts. And we are susceptible for it to go to our head. And we're thinking we're above the law. Muriel.
I could also read that as a negative towards slavery.
Yes, that is correct. I definitely agree with that. We are not meant to lord over other people. That is not what we're about. See, I'm going to be using the words. Is it okay to have a servant? Is it okay to hire someone to work for you? Absolutely. Why? Because that's a job. Someone can be in a position in a hierarchy of where they call the shots. There can be such a thing called a boss, an employer, and an employee. Nothing wrong with that. But lording it over someone where you think you own them, that's what you're talking about, Muriel, right? Yeah, yes. That's what he's saying. What Shmaya is teaching us is loathe not the person who's in a position of leadership. That's not what's being said. But loathe that position of authority, the position, not the person. Why? Because if that person is being authoritative to the point of where they're lording it over you, They're not utilizing their position of leadership properly. And you have to be careful, right? Even, let's soften it a little bit. Let's assume the boss is a great guy. Let's assume it. I think it's fair to assume there are some wonderful bosses who run some wonderful businesses and organizations. Great. Is there anything wrong with that? The answer is no. There's nothing wrong with that. However, that person needs to be aware that the aggravation, the stress, what that position now brings into your life has an impact on you. Don't, how do I put this? Don't be rushing to take that position. It comes with some serious pitfalls to your mental health, to your physical health. Here's a great trivia question. Which one of the 12 sons of Jacob, which one of the 12 tribes died the first? Who was the first to die?
Joseph.
Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Yisachar, Zvulun, Yosef, Binyamin.
Yosef.
Who was it?
Yosef.
You sure?
Yeah.
How do you know that?
I just read it.
Yeah? Does it say why?
Because he was an authority.
Yeah. It's that simple, folks. The Torah goes out of the way. It doesn't tell us how old Reuven was when he died. Doesn't tell us how old Shimon was when he died. It does tell us Levi, but for a different reason. It doesn't tell us most of the tribes what age they died. It tells us Yosef died when he did. Why? So the commentary, Talmud says, because it took its toll. His position of leadership took a toll on him. Positions of leadership and authority. I'm presenting to you two insights here. I'm not being as clear as I can be. The two insights are, number one is that for your sake, you in that position of authority, there are pitfalls for you. There are risks for you. It will take its toll on your well-being. And it puts you in a position of susceptibility of it going to your head and becoming arrogant and becoming tyrannical, becoming authoritative to the point of lording it up. Power corrupts. It's just a reality and you have to know it. That doesn't mean you should shy away. If there's a need, you step up and you do what you have to do, but be on guard. Who has the highest position in Judaism as far as a leadership position? What position is considered the highest level?
A rabbi.
Nope.
Well,
oh, if only.
Moses or Jacob or Joseph.
The president of the congregation.
Okay, that's true. But how about, maybe let me refine the question. If you were looking at the hierarchy of Torah Judaism, of all the different positions.
Kohen Gadol.
You would have thought, but there's actually someone higher in position.
Hashem?
A person.
Okay.
The head of the community.
The king.
The Melech is the highest political leader for the Jewish people. Yes, the Kohen Gadol might be the cohort in terms of the spiritual leader, but the political leader is the Melech. Do you know that the Melech has a mitzvah that none of us have? You and I do not have this mitzvah. And that is the Melech, the king, is required to keep with him at all times a Sefer Torah. Why? Why? For exactly this reason. Because he is the most susceptible to think he's above the law. Because absolute power corrupts absolutely. He needs to be reminded wherever he goes, I'm not the one in authority. I'm bound by the same laws as the commoner. I'm bound. I'm not above the law. I'll show you how susceptible it is. This is fascinating. We'll get to it, God willing, in Parshat Vayikra, the beginning of the third book of the Torah. It lists in that Parsha, it's usually the Parsha where we start to glaze over because it's about the sacrifices and yawn. However, This year, I implore you, read it a little more carefully and find something. But listen to this. It lists the different sins, that groupings, categories of people that need to bring sin offerings. Okay, here we go. If the anointed Kohen will sin, then bringing guilt upon the people, his sin, here's what he's got to do. But I want you to focus. You ready? I'm going to read the phrase again. If the anointed Kohen will sin. Next paragraph. If the entire assembly of Israel shall err, and that's referring to the Sanhedrin, if they make a mistake, they have to bring certain offerings. Next paragraph. When the ruler sins and commits one, you notice the change there?
Yeah.
It went from if to when. Next paragraph. If an individual person from among the people of the land. Everybody is if. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But a ruler, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Fact. The Torah's words are so precise because that is the reality. If you don't have the sovereignty of the Torah reminding us what's right and what's wrong, you're bound to make that mistake. You're bound. It's gonna happen because leadership and positions of authority have that susceptibility. Okay, let's take this last one. Perfect timing here. We're right on schedule. Okay, let's look at this last one. V'al tisvada l'rashut, and avoid closeness, avoid being too close, overly close with the government. Why? Isn't the government a wonderful entity? The answer is yes. He doesn't say avoid. He doesn't say don't get involved. Don't be politically active. That's not what he says. He says don't become overly close with the government. Why? What's so bad about that?
The closer you are with the government, perhaps the more you forget about your relationship with God.
Okay, that's certainly a possibility, right? We think, to Marcia's point, we talked about this a long time ago, but the question always bothered me until I found that what I think is an extremely satisfactory answer. How could people really serve idols? Like, come on. I have to assume that people back then were at least as smart as I am. I mean, at least. They probably were smarter. It's hard for me to fathom that the Torah would go out of its way to tell us what was so pervasive until Avraham came along. And even after Avraham, in our own history, how many times the prophets warned us, stop serving these idols, whether it was the Baal, or whether it was Asherah, or whether it was Mercoles. You have all these different idols. There would be no prohibition in the Torah. There's no prohibition in the Torah, to the best of my knowledge, that says, don't be stupid. There is no. It would be nice, but I think we'd all be guilty. But how come? Because the Torah doesn't have to tell you that. It's called common sense. Don't do stupid things. There's no such prohibition. So why is there a prohibition? Not one, but many. Don't serve other gods. Don't serve idols. Don't make graven images. Why? If that's just a figment of some idiot's imagination, then why would the Torah be so worried about it? And it makes it to God's top 10.
Because it happens, it's happening now.
Why? What's the allure? Susan, do you wake up in the morning saying, man, I can't wait to rub Buddha's belly? Do you wake up thinking that?
No, I do not wake up saying that, but there are some individuals that the idol changes its form. These days, the idol worshiping, having a whole lot of money.
Right. I'm with you. I get it. That's a nice, what we call hashkafic perspective. That's a general perspective. I'm talking about graven images, real idols. I don't mean the conceptual. I'm with you, Susan. There's no question that we have substituted the golden image for the money image. I'm with you. However, I've always been bothered. How could someone really bow down to a statue and think that inanimate object that the dude just made last week, it was shipped in and it says at the bottom, made in China before the tariff, right? How could he truly believe that?
Because it's a physical thing you can see where our belief in God.
And if I turn my back on it, Fred, and I say, ah, you're a piece of garbage. Yeah. What's going to happen? Nothing. It doesn't have ears to hear me. So I'm playing it up. But there clearly was an allure. There was a tremendous. Now, the Talmud does say that the rabbis did pray to remove a tremendous level of that yearning, that of wanting to serve. That was taken away. But it still boggled my mind until I learned the following. And it's so true. How did it start? Adam believed in God. I'm sure Adam's children believed in God, and I'm sure their children believed. So at what point did somebody wake up and said, I want to create a statue? It's like, why, where, when? I do know that from the time of Adam until you get to Abraham, that's where it goes. It's somewhere in that time period. It doesn't say, by the way, by the flood of Noah, it doesn't say that God was upset with them worshiping idols. It doesn't say that. What ticked God off there was theft, stealing, robbery, that kind of stuff. But by the time you get to Avraham, that's like center stage, all about idols. And Avraham, the Medjur says that Avraham knocked out all his father's idols. And we all know the story. Where did that come from? I'll give you the quick version here. This is really important. Everybody recognized in the beginning that God was the master of the universe. But at the same time, everybody recognized that God appointed his cabinet. He appointed his closest circle of ministers to do his bidding. He created a sun to give light and warmth to the world. He created clouds. He created a sky. He created rain. He created all these things that are, so to say, God's agents, God's ministers to do his bidding. Everybody knew that. But if you're a farmer, right? Sid, you're a farmer and you know you need rain. What is it that you're focused on? Are you focused on you can't wait to see those clouds in the sky forming so that the rain will come? Or are you being so philosophical that you're like, oh God, I know you're all powerful. The sun is amazing, but I need rain. The answer is you probably do a little bit of both. But you're looking towards that which you can relate to. The people, when they first started, they didn't believe that the clouds were the actual God. They knew God was the master of it all. But their closest relationship, the closest thing for them, to use Fred's word, that was tangible for them that they could see and relate to was when the cumulus clouds came and formed the rain and had rain. And after a period of time, they started associating, we need rain. We need rain. Not we need God's rain. We need rain. We need rain. Oh, good. Here come the clouds. Let's pray that it's a good rain. And over time, people started to associate with the intermediaries, the ministers, and forgot that there's an owner. Forgot that there's a master over all of it. It devolved over time. Do you know what a non-Jew, a Gentile, in terminology is called in the Talmud? It's called Oved Kochavim. Translate. Oved means who serves.
Someone who serves the stars.
Serves the stars. And I'm not talking Hollywood. Serves the stars up in heaven. Why? Because that's the constellations. Oh, when the stars are aligned a certain way, that's what comes energy to the world. And that's what they started to pray to. That's the term for the Gentile who serves idol. He's called an Oved Kochavim. Oved Kochavim Umazalot, if you really want to be technical. He's called an Akum. Right, right, Jeff? Akum. Which is the acronym, yeah. Oved Kochavim Umazalot. Mazalot are the constellations. That's what it is. That's where they, not because they're crazy, not because they're stupid, not at all. This was their misguided attempt. They forgot. That's like me going to the cashier at the store and saying, hey, I'm a rabbi. Can you give me a clergy discount? And she looks at me like I'm from Mars. I say, I'm not the owner. Go, if you want to get a clergy discount, go speak to the owner. She's right. Now, I wouldn't do that, but that's the idea. You're trying to pay off the middleman. Jeff.
But it was pretty clearly expressed by the people at Mount Sinai that that's what they needed or wanted or whatever.
After Mount Sinai with the golden calf.
With the golden calf, yeah.
Correct. And God understood that. And immediately the day after, he instructed them to build a tabernacle so that there would be some physical way of, but no idols, no forms, nothing to pray to, a place that we can focus on. That's fine. But no actual idols. And this is true, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, this is true for people as well. We don't serve people. We don't elevate any living or dead person to a quasi, even quasi status of a god. We don't deify anyone. Why? Because that is an exclusive realm of God. Is it easier when you're there? Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with that. I get it. But that's where the mistake came from. So you have to be wary. How did we get here?
About the government.
Yeah, what about it?
Don't be intimate with it.
Right. Mm-hmm. 1 second. Why? Oh, because Marcia, you said it because, right? What did you say?
You would become more involved with the government.
Right, and you forget. That's what it was. Right. You become and you think the government is the answer to all your questions, and you forget that there's a God. Thank you. That's the connection here. That's where idol worship began, is that you found the middleman. That's what's paying it off. Don't, you have to be careful. But the truth is, it's late already now. I always do that. There's one other aspect, and it's almost like a play on words. It's a play on words, and you have to see the word in Hebrew. This last word here, don't become too close. Here it is, l'rashut. L'rashut, rashut means that which is permissible. Like for many people, when they make a bracha on behalf of everybody else, they say, birshut, with the permission of, right? They say, like I do it at my house, right? Birshut, maranon, v'rabanon, v'rabotai, baruch atah Hashem, right? Whatever the bracha is. But you're asking permission. It's not the literal meaning of the Mishnah, and it's really focused the way we translated it, but as a play on words, I found a commentary that loved it, and I loved it. It says, don't become overly familiar with that which you allow yourself permissibility. Don't give yourself a heter. Don't give yourself a leniency for every time you want to do something. You know, I want to do it. I'm sure this is fine. I had many times, and I hope I don't offend anybody, right? Somebody says to me, is this item kosher? I said, I don't really know. All I can tell you is that there's no rabbinical, there's no kosher supervision that's marked on it. Rabbi, what are the odds that something not kosher is in there? It's only X or whatever it is. The answer is, I don't know. I'm not saying it's not, but I can't say for sure it is because there's no... We allow ourselves the permissibility to say, oh, what are the odds? Come on, seriously. Says Shmaya, don't be so overly close with permissibility. Be strict, you know, be on point. Don't always assume that, oh yeah, it's fine until proven otherwise. That's generally my motto. People ask me, is it okay? I say, until I know otherwise, yeah. But that's the general idea. It's almost a joke. Right? Don't be so familiar to allow yourself to just, you know, I have permission to do it. Rationalizations are so easy. Don't be so comfortable with rationalizations. If you're not sure, maybe err on the side of caution. You're right. If this is the last thing on earth and you don't have anything else to eat, gesundheit, go ahead and eat it. No problem. You won't hear any argument from me. But something short of that, yeah, you can live without the Twinkie. You can live without it. It's not the end of the world. I don't know if that's kosher or not. I'm just using that as an example. But, right, okay, you're starving. You're not starving. You're hungry. I get it. It's the only thing. Okay, so push yourself an hour. You push yourself on Yom Kippur for a few hours. Okay, wait till you get home. You get something kosher. Don't be so overly permissive. That's a play on words here. Okay, so this is step one. Shmaya's take on being careful, this cautious wording of being careful of the dangers involved with overly engaging with governments, political movements. It's not in your best interest. You know that your loyalties have to be where you are as a Jew. They're not always aligned. Be careful. And if you are in a position of leadership, whether it's in the government or your home or your boss or your job, or whatever, recognize that you're susceptible to the dangers. Don't lord it over anybody. Work with them. Yes, give guidance. Can you get upset? Yes, you can get upset if the job isn't being done right. I'm with you on all of that, but not to the extent of lording it and loving that position of authority. That's not what we're all about. Moshe Rabbeinu had the greatest position in all time. And he remained what? Humble. He remained humble. That's what we have to strive for. He's not saying don't take a position of leadership. Hate the position of authority. That being authoritative. Be careful with it. Any questions? Fabulous. Okay.
Yes. Is it the last one you're saying not to be too close to the government? Is it also more that the government has its people that have different values than what your values may be from
could
the Torah,
be.
And that you don't
it
want
could be.
You don't the want truth, to get too close to other values?
Correct, correct. But I'll add one more piece at the expense that I'm going to get my head handed to me. I'm not very big into politics. I'm really not, and don't try to entice me. It's not going to work. I'm not interested. However, one thing becomes very clear. If you take a step back and just look at the political landscape, I don't care what sides you're on, the overwhelming majority of politicians are not in it for you. They're in it for them. Their interests often, perhaps most often, come first. Now, is that the way it's supposed to be? No, it's not. These are elected people. They are elected by the people, for the people. Again, not looking to politicize this, but this is a constant problem. Politicians put their interests before the people. They are called, they should be, public servants. That's what an elected official is, public servant. Unfortunately, where we are in today's day and age, and I mean that over the past many, many years, we have lost sight of that. And it becomes nothing more than how do I get reelected? How do I keep my position of authority? How do I continue to lord? It's completely out of control. And I think part and parcel of this Mishnah is to be very wary of how close we get, because it's not in our best interest when it's against their best interest. Be careful. And this applies to how the government gives out, what the government gives out, what we rely on. Shmaya and Avtalia next week, God willing, they are all going to stress the idea of self-worth and independence. Love work. You can do this. Don't rely on government. Don't rely on every handout, on every program, and every... That's not necessarily enough. Yes, we do have to because we need it for certain things. I'm not suggesting not to. However, be very, very careful. Susan.
You've given me a new project to take on, which is
you've come up with a solution to something, which is starting a GoFundMe to purchase a Torah to send to the White House. Because I think that having, you know, isn't that necessary? Can't you imagine that? Like on the desk there?
Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Sadly, not going to work. But staying above the fray, I'm going to take Shmaya's opinion. I'm going to take his words to heart and stay out of the fray. All right. Thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful week, and we'll reconvene, God willing, next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.